My name is Wyvon Hutchinson, and I'm the Senior Director of Law and Human Rights at the La Isla Foundation, which is a small NGO based in Nicaragua that works to address the epidemic of chronic kidney disease of non-traditional causes affecting sugarcane workers in Mesoamerica with the focus on Nicaragua. For me, this topic is particularly interesting because the worker population that I study is disproportionately affected by this disease. They also contend with chronic dehydration and frequent agrochemical exposure. The rights-based approach that I use in my work explores these risk factors and attempts to incorporate these concerns into our efforts to increase protection. In different ways and in much more depth than I, today's panelists all explore the interplay between health, human rights, and the environment. But before I introduce them, I would like to give you a bit of a background on the state of policy and normative conceptualization of these linkages. The 1972 Stockholm Declaration of the UN Conference on the Human Environment is one of the first international legal instruments that establishes a foundation for linking human rights, health, and environmental protection, declaring that man has the fundamental right to freedom, equality, and adequate conditions of life in an environment of quality that permits a life of dignity and well-being. Linkages between the environment, health, and human rights are also implicitly or explicitly mentioned in the 1966 International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the 1989 Convention on the Rights of the Child, the 1992 Rio Declaration on Environment and Development, the 1998 Convention on Access to Information, Public Participation, and Access to Justice in Environmental Matters, and the 1999 Protocol on Water and Health to the Helsinki Water Courses. There are several ways in which the linkage between public health, human rights, and the environment can be understood. One of these ways is the one that most closely embodies the approach of the Helsinki Convention that says linkage can be understood in that environmental protection is seen as a precondition to the enjoyment of internationally guaranteed human rights, particularly the right to life and health. The second approach, as illustrated in the Rio Convention, views certain human rights as essential elements to achieving environmental protection, which has as its principal aim the protection of human health. Finally, the third way views the links between environment, health, and human rights as indivisible, characterizing the right to a safe and healthy working environment as an independent substantive human right. The linkages between public health, human rights, and the environment can and have been explored in the context of a wide array of issues, from climate change to resource management to occupational health to environmental pollution and toxic exposure. Today, we'll discuss the experiences of those who employ human rights and environmental rights-based approaches to increase public health protection. I'm going to start with Dr. Tom Kearns, who's the Director of Environment and Human Rights Advisory, a nonprofit which provides human rights information and analysis services to private firms, government agencies, and environmental organizations. Dr. Kearns is also an emeritus professor of philosophy at Seattle Community College and the author of the book Environmentally Induced Illness, Ethics, Risk Assessment, and Human Rights. The title of his presentation is Environmental Human Rights Impact Assessments, Three Case Studies. Through the discussion of three distinct case studies, Dr. Kearns' presentation will address the topic of human rights impact assessments and their potential to increase protection, particularly in the case of toxic exposure. Following Dr. Kearns' presentation, Dr. Jennifer Crowe will go. Dr. Crowe is an occupational and environmental health researcher at SALTRA out of the National University in Costa Rica. Dr. Crowe's presentation, Heat and Sugarcane Harvesters, the Case for Intervention Under Current Conditions and in the Context of Climate Change, shares recent data on heat exposure in sugarcane harvesters and discusses the data in the context of the epidemic of chronic kidney disease of non-traditional origin in Mesoamerica, as well as in the context of climate change. Finally, Professor Colin Crawford, who will be joining us shortly, is a law professor and the executive director at the Payson Center for International Development at Tulane Law School. Professor Crawford's presentation, Public Participation, Climate Change, and Environmental Justice, will explore how robust ground-up public participation models might be developed to create more active, engaged citizens seeking ways to improve their own health and living conditions in the process of climate change adaptation strategies, particularly in the case of poor populations. Each panelist will be allotted approximately 15 to 20 minutes for their presentation. Upon conclusion of the presentations, the panelists will be invited to ask each other questions, and then we'll open up questions to the room. So without further delay, I'd like to begin with Dr. Kearns. Dr. Kearns, thank you for joining us. I'll go ahead and just give you a 10-minute warning and then a 5-minute warning.
Okay. Okay. When APHA asks you to do an abstract for a presentation like this, they also ask for your credentials. Why should we listen to you? That kind of thing. So you listen. You list, you know, your work and degrees and books and stuff. But the thing I didn't list, forgot to list on there, is that I became chemically sensitive about 18 or 20 years ago. And boy, when that happens, you become a chemical detection machine. And you discover experientially what maybe you only knew academically before about the extent of toxics in the environment. So that's one of the things that got me interested in this stuff and has continued to motivate me. And you suddenly realize that there are human rights implications for environmental toxics. So what we're going to do here is look just a couple of preliminary things first, and then what human rights impact assessments are, and then three case studies, one in New Zealand about protecting people from herbicide sprays on road shoulders, second one about fracking in the United Kingdom, and a third about a proposed aerial pesticide spray adjacent to a little rural town in Oregon. And then we'll look at the three different approaches, three different strategies at those three different situations, how they use their human rights impact assessments. But a couple of things just to start. One is two things. I think they'll take less than a minute each. One is just a reminder of where human rights originated, at least the modern human rights movement, originated after World War II as a response to horrific events that had been perpetrated in Central Europe by a democratic society led by democratically elected leaders who appointed properly appointed officials and ministers, and whose legislature made these horrific acts not only possible but mandatory, and that were carried out by ordinary people doing their ordinary jobs. So, and yet those acts, according to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, outraged the conscience of mankind. So that's just a reminder that living in democracies where things are done by law is not necessarily a protection against anything. So that's one thing. And the second thing, so out of that came these various, a whole slew of human rights instruments. The two big ones to start with were the Nuremberg Code in 1947, Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 48, and then these several other. By the way, this is big enough to read, I hope, so I don't have to say them all. A few human rights norms that are used in human rights impact assessments. And now, the second preliminary thing, since you got a philosophy professor up here, is something about syllogisms. And we learned this from Aristotle, that any practical syllogism, that is, any argument in which the conclusion is, therefore, we should do X, or therefore, we should not do X. Any practical syllogism requires two premises. The first is a set of facts about a situation, but the facts alone about any situation don't tell you what should be done. You need a second premise that's a value premise that says, and given this set of facts and given this set of values, here's what should be done. And so the facts in an environmental situation might be an environmental impact assessment, ideally a human health impact assessment, and maybe even an economic and social impact assessment. Those would provide factual grounds. And then you want a second premise that could come from any number of places. We should maximize health. That might be a value. We should maximize autonomy. That might be a value. We should do cost-benefit analysis. But I think I think the human rights as a value approach is important and has some advantages that we can talk about later if we have time. Okay, three So what human rights impact assessments entail include are, first of all, a set of, I brought some copies, hard copies of some that are free to take if you want, a description of the basic, unquestioned, uncontroversial facts about a given situation, like here's what the roadside spray program is, then the concerns that the community has, and then a list of human rights norms that are at issue in this situation, a list of the each norm, what its source is, what instruments it comes from, and how each of those norms is relevant in this particular situation. And then the liabilities that would be faced by that company or that government agency that's doing this thing, and recommendations for what they should do to minimize their liabilities and to meet their human rights obligations. So that's what's entailed. Three case studies, New Zealand, the UK, and Oregon. The first one, they're trying to protect people who drive on county, state, or national roadways that are protected, where the vegetation is controlled by herbicide use. So that means anybody, and if I were to ask for a show of hands, how many of you have driven on county or state or interstate roadways in the last week, everybody would raise their hand. So everybody is exposed to these herbicide residues, and they last for the half-life of many of these is months to years, so you're exposed at length. So this group decided to, has been fighting this in Auckland for 3 years, and this is just a list of some of the things they've done over the last 3 years. That's the start of the list. And they documented each one of these steps. So what they want to be able to show when they get to the human rights stage of this thing is that they have taken every possible measure approach that they can. And last line there, they've all to no avail, it's been a dead zone. One of them says, we have followed the decision-making process at every turn, always putting forward the facts, never abusing, always straightforward, backed up with science. One of them, for example, is a pesticide expert who testifies at the UN for various things. All to no avail. So they commissioned about 6 or 8 months ago a human rights impact assessment, and we completed it a few weeks ago, and they have asked now to present it at the November meeting of Auckland Transport. They haven't heard yet whether they'll be able to. This is what the front page of that report looks like. It's addressed to that guy who's the chairman of Auckland Transport and to the mayor of Auckland, and it's commissioned by the Auckland group. Includes those elements, the HRA includes those elements, and what they want Auckland to do is return to their previous practice of using hot water and steam and mechanical methods for vegetation control and quit using herbicides. Their HRA has not yet been made public. I asked them if I could have permission to tell you about it, and they said, yeah, you tell them, but don't hand them copies, but if it were to leak out somehow, that we already have this human rights impact assessment, that might not be a terrible thing, because I don't think Auckland Transport really believes we did it. So that's one case. And the unique thing about them is all the work they did beforehand and that how well they documented all those steps. And another interesting thing that they did was they've been collecting personal narratives from all the people who are directly impacted and feel acute impacts from herbicide sprays, and they're going to attach some of those personal narratives to each of the human rights norms in this HRA. Okay, second is an example of HRA as fracking in the United Kingdom. And this was co-authored, was commissioned by the Bianca Jagger Human Rights Foundation about a year ago, and co-authored by these three organizations along the bottom there, the Global Network for the Study of Human Rights in the Environment, that's Anna Greer as the director. She's also the editor of the Journal of Human Rights in the Environment. and Environment Human Rights Advisory, that's me, and the director of the Human Rights Consortium at the School of Advanced Study at the University of London, that's Damien. And so the three of us have been working on this for a little over a year, and we pulled in a couple other authors who are also law professors, at one at the University of the West of England and one at Swansea University, and one philosophy professor who doesn't know anything about law. And the unique thing about this HRIA is that it's focused primarily on a legal approach rather than a moral approach. It's primarily a legal approach to human rights because the UK has actual human rights laws that can be appealed to, and that they do appeal to. 10 minutes. So what's one of the things that's unique about this HRIA is it's co-authored by four different people, has a more legal than moral approach, and that it's a preliminary HRIA. It lays out sort of a prima facie case for human rights impacts of fracking in the UK and calls on the UK government to do a full, scientifically based, industry independent, if that's even possible, field human rights impact assessment, and to put it out in the public domain and allow for public discussion of it, and include a moratorium on all exploratory and extractive drilling until that's been completed. So preliminary actions that they took before the HRA, our team didn't do anything, but any preliminary actions, but the, of course, been lots of protests and civil actions in the UK. So this is what it calls on the UK to do. This was launched, so this HRA was launched by Bianca Jagger Foundation, Human Rights Foundation, a couple weeks ago, and their post-HRA strategy so far is to present the report physically, hand it over to number 10 Downing Street, and to have Bianca there, and three of our authors, and the media, of course. And then on that same day, and some members of Parliament also, and then on that same day they go over to Parliament and have a lunch at the House of Lords. I just got an email from Bianca yesterday that says it's all set up. They're going to have a lunch with folks. And then they'll present it to Parliament and the media, of course. So that's their post. And some of these folks also have connections at the UN, so they're hoping to make it an international issue as well as local. And then the third situation is a proposed aerial spray of pesticides over 150 acres of forestry property that is immediately adjacent, I mean the boundary lines are the same, to a little town, Waldport, Oregon. 2,000 people live there, and this forestry company, Forest Capital Partners, big company, doesn't know anything about it. They don't even know where their properties are, practically. I mean, they're so big, so they hire helicopter companies to go out and spray the herbicides. And so that was their plan. And then in this little town of 2,000 people, you know, they're all busy. They have jobs, two jobs. They have kids. They get sick sometimes. So some of them are retired and can't do much. And yet there are two or three or four people there that called meetings few times, and they were worried about the acute effects. There's a neighborhood right on that property line, and there's a school, middle school and a high school, about half a mile away, and these things drift a lot, of course. So they're concerned about children's health. Had a few community meetings. They had written a formal request, you know, the citizens to the headquarters of Forest Capital Partners said, would you please not spray. If you have to spray, do it with backpacks walking up, you know, around the property. It's only 150 acres. Please don't helicopters, I don't know if you know, they make drift horrible. And it's mountainous, which is the reason that the company didn't want to do a backpack spray. It's hard to get around in that property. And the mayor had written a letter and called him and so on, and they said, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to do it. So they thought, well, let's have an HRIA done. And so this was done, addressed to the presidents of Forest Capital Partners and copied to Department of Agriculture, in Oregon at least. Department of Agriculture and Forestry have pretty much identical interests. They're hardly separate. The Attorney General, Public Health, Mayor of Walport, and so on, mailed it off. And what it requires, it lists the human rights norms of concern. It outlines Forest Capital Partners' liabilities, recommends measures they should take to reduce their liabilities and meet their human rights obligations. Mailed that off. About 3 or 4 days later, the Walpole mayor gets a letter from Forest Capital Partners saying, oh, okay, we'll do backpack sprays. So the interesting thing about that one is it's such an ordinary little community with people who, you know, were just scared for themselves and their kids, and nothing was working, and they asked for an HRA, and boom, it worked. So these are some measures for strengthening HRA reports. And there are some advantages, I think, to, I just had a paper published a year or so ago titled 10 Practical Advantages of Using a Human Rights Approach in Environmental Advocacy, and these are a few of those. I think there are some benefits of HRIAs, and then we'll be done here, is that human rights impact assessment sort of documents and endorses and sort of ratifies the moral intuitions that people have that that's just outrageous that they can do that. And this human rights assessment says, you're right, it's outrageous, and here's why. So it, just like scientific studies document matters of fact about a situation, an HRIA documents matters of moral intuition about justice. It can provide ammunition and sort of activate, energize activists. And, you know, there might be something in there that a smart attorney could use to bring a case. And so it can rehearse, sort of pre-rehearse some things that might be usable in a court someday. So to our question, can HRAs help reduce environmental toxics and protect public health? The answer is it can be one more tool that can contribute and that can sometimes help, sometimes a little, sometimes a lot.